Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Warlock Holmes by G.S. Denning. Narrated by Scott McCormick. With performances by Eric Messner, Michael John Casey, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Mort Shelby, Bradley Smith, Steve Winall, Yasmin Toison, Ken Jackson, Nick DePinto, and Bob Payne.
Warlock Holmes and the Rye Gateway to Another World. As I lay in slumber one night in early spring, I was awakened by an early spring storm just outside my window. I listened in case I was being summoned by Holmes, who often called me to help button his shirt and such. His mummified fingers had their limitations. The wind rattled the panes, and as it curled over the rooftops and around London's irregular forest of chimneys, the wind took on that familiar, hollow muttering. It sounded like an old woman chiding herself, or on the occasion of a particularly potent gust, as if it were calling out, "Holmes." My nighttime imagination can be a macabre thing, yet the safety of a good bed is one of life's greatest comforts, and this benefit is increased, not diminished, by the sound of a storm whose winds cannot penetrate one's sanctum. I pulled the blankets up around my shoulders, settled in, and smiled for about 6 seconds. And I had the sudden realization that I wished to speak to the exact same person. Holmes! I leapt from my bed. Holmes, the wind is asking for you.
What does it want?
I don't know. I haven't inquired.
But won't you, Watson? I am somewhat indisposed.
This was true. Holmes remained in feeble shape. He spent his days and nights propped up in his bed, begging for toast and soup, slowly recomposing. No, Holmes, you don't understand. It is not normal for the wind to speak.
I'm surprised at you, Watson. Afraid of a little wind.
Also, it seems to have opened the front door.
So it seems unlikely to be just the wind, then.
Holmes, it's coming up the stairs.
Best get out of bed, then.
Dashed impertinence, all hours, honestly. It's ridiculous.
Get the door, Watson.
What?
Well, it's just such a long way over there, you know. I'm really not at my best. I'll just stand here in the hall and speak to whatever it is.
Holmes, are you sure that's wise?
You are perfectly safe, Watson, I assure you.
Despite my companion's history of frequently incorrectly assuring my safety, I crept closer to the door. Holmes, are you sure?
Yes, yes.
I girded my loins. I gritted my teeth. I opened the door. There was nothing there. Then the scarecrow leaned in from its hiding place beside the door and grabbed me by the throat. He smelled musty and wet. His clothes hung dank and weathered around his fence pole frame. His fingers were dried, scratchy sticks. His face a grinning pumpkin stuck atop a rough-hewn pole. In his rictus smile, there was something that closely resembled triumph. I cannot answer to his effectiveness at frightening crows, but it worked pretty well on me. I froze, forgetting to struggle for a moment, stunned by the impertinence of the beast. If someone must be strangled, why then someone must be strangled? Yet I see no reason or excuse to do it so disrespectfully. I paused, unsure whether to fight for my life or reproach the thing for its churlishness. As I dithered, the air around me exploded with purple light. Bolts of violet flame howled past me in irregular arcs and slammed into my scarecrow assailant. The final blast caught the scarecrow right in the middle of the brow. His head exploded into purple flaming wads of pumpkin glop, which spattered themselves all across the opposite wall and the front of my nightshirt. The wrecked scarecrow collapsed backwards into a corner and moved no more.
Oh, there. That's all settled. Back to bed.
Why are you here?
Watson, hush! Do you want to wake Mrs. Hudson? Please, please do not wake Mrs. Hudson. Oh, I don't know how I could tolerate her at the moment.
But what was that thing?
Oh, you know, just one of those pumpkin scarecrow monster thingies. They're quite common. You read about them in the paper all the time.
No, you don't!
Well, of course you do. I think one of them, oh, I don't know, robbed a bank last week or something.
He was edging back toward this room, eager to end this conversation. Yet I was unwilling to let him go.
Well known, is it? In all the papers. What are they called, then, if everybody is so familiar with them?
Oh, you know, pumpkin scared thing with crows. Pump crow. That was it, merely a pump crow, Watson.
Pump crow? A pump crow?
But it was too late. Holmes fell down upon his mattress, and there he lay, insensible to the world. Shaking with anger and no small amount of residual fear, I turned and stomped off to my room. When I awoke, well, no, that is a lie. When I decided it was time to stop fearfully huddling under my blankets, I found Holmes still sprawled out upon his bed. Feeling that I needed some air, I hurriedly dressed and stepped out. There, just outside our door, amidst the wreckage of our pump crow assailant, stood Mrs. Hudson. She did not look well pleased by the morning's discovery. Lacking an explanation, I realized my only hope lay in taking the offensive.
Mrs. Hudson, I realize that this is your home and decorating choices outside my rented chambers are not mine to make. Nevertheless, madam, Holmes and I do business here, and I think we would be most appreciative if in the future you could maintain an entryway decor that is more welcoming to our visitors.
Once I was out on Baker Street, I let my feet carry me where they would. I had no destination, only troubled thoughts. Holmes could not stay in London, that much was clear. He had too many enemies and too many friends. Moriarty's men and the occasional pump crow seemed to have no difficulty determining his whereabouts, and I could think of no better time to strike at Holmes than now. If word got out that he was enfeebled, the previous evening's assault might prove to be only the opening act of a greater tragedy. What would stop Grogson and Lestrade coming round as soon as they got a case that stumped them to quite interrupt Holmes' recovery? The more I thought it over, the more I realized. If a moment's peace were on the cards for Warlock Holmes, it would not be found on Baker Street. Here, let me pause to mention one of Holmes' most infuriating traits. His remarkable good fortune. Let us suppose Holmes were in the mood to read the newspaper, but had not. He might go to the window to catch a breeze, and while there, he might stretch his hand out to check for rain. As soon as he did it, a cart driver on the street below would suffer a sudden heart attack. His cart, loaded with innumerable panes of window glass, would veer astray, plunging through man and horse and flower girl alike, tipping the glass left and right, and generally shredding half the people on the street until it at last collided with a newsstand. slicing the proprietor into several dozen meaty strips and propelling hundreds of newspapers high into the air, one of which would land, neat as you like, in Holmes's extended palm. My own luck was identical, except that instead of a newspaper landing in my outstretched hand, it would be a dismembered loop of the newspaperman's abdominal viscera. This would surely be followed by all the surviving people on the street crying out, "Tragedy! Catastrophe! Oh, please, is there a doctor present who wouldn't mind patching up our several dozen wounds for no financial compensation?" In those early days, I still supposed this to be blind luck. I had yet to realize that it was, in fact, demons doing subtle, unbidden favors for Holmes. As is evidenced by what happened next, the exact second I decided that Holmes must leave London, I caught my walking stick between two cobblestones, slipped sideways, and tipped bodily into the fellow to my right. I was beginning to form an apology when I caught a glimpse of who it was I had upset and immediately snapped to a salute. I would not have thought I served long enough for such things to become habit, but there I was, spine straight, fingers to my brow.
"Sir! Colonel Hayter, sir!"
The old gentleman blinked twice and squinted at me for a moment.
Hello, Hayter. Well, that's Watson, isn't it?
Sir!
At ease, Watson. No need for such formalities. I'm retired, you know. Would have thought you would be too after that gunshot wound.
I am, sir. Only I suppose you surprised me. Dreadfully sorry. Where are you bound, Colonel?
I thought I'd take a walk in the park, only I can't find the damn thing. It has to be around here somewhere.
Just around the corner, sir. Shall I see you to it?
Oh, that would be capital, Watson. Capital!
So I led my former commander back past my rooms, towards Regent's Park. Though it had only been a few years since I'd seen him last, he appeared notably more grey, more bent. It made me sad to see him so. I'd always liked the man.
How is it that you find yourself in London, sir?
I don't know. I just wandered here, I think.
I thought you had that country place down in Surrey near... What was it?
Reigate. Reigate is its name. God damn the place. God damn! The devil made that place, Watson, which I would not have minded if he had not then deeded it to me.
But I always thought the idea of retiring to be a country squire was rather nice.
Did you know, Watson? Did you know that the snow stayed unseasonably late this year? And yet, the lilac buds came 2 days earlier. Did you know that? I did. Why? Because it's the most exciting thing that's happened to me in these whole 2 years. Hellish place.
Oh, well, perhaps invite some visitors?
Oh, I tried. Come down to the country, I said. That's what Londoners do, isn't it? They get sick and go to the country to recuperate. I set up the whole South Wing as an infirmary. You know what I got? My milksop fartwit nephew came down because he had the flu. Moped around for a week or so before he realized just how boring Surrey is. And then he ran off. Then my niece got the vapors after reading a saucy French novel. She only lasts 2 days, and I can't say I miss it either. Oh, I want real patient Watson. A man with stories to tell, with scars, with some horrid tropical disease that's slowly dissolving him. You know?
So what you want most in the world is to provide an out-of-London getaway to an odd, interesting person who has horrible physical afflictions?
In a perfect world, yes. But, you know, we don't always get what we want, do we, Watson?
You might, sir. I really think you might.
I had smuggled Holmes out by night, with a blanket over his head, into a waiting carriage and the curtains drawn. To be caught with a corpse in one's possession is one thing. To be caught with a corpse that walks around and asks for soup is quite another. Colonel Hayter had met us at the door of his home, as we had agreed, and helped me spirit Holmes out of the sight of the driver and into the infirmary. When I was sure we were unobserved, I handed Hayter the corner of the blanket and allowed him to open Holmes up like a Christmas present.
Good God! He's marvelous!
Thank you, good sir. You seem to be a most impressive gentleman yourself.
From that instant, the two of them were fast friends. Their chief entertainment was in declaring boredom, a practice at which they sometimes tried to best one another, or else they served as a sympathetic ear to the other's travails.
You see that laurel branch out there? Do you see it?
It was the third morning after our arrival. The Colonel was spending far too much time with Holmes, if indeed this trip were for rest and recovery's sake. Yet his presence so delighted my friend that even as a doctor, I felt it was not an unwelcome thing.
I think I see the one you mean.
Well, it's awful. Look at it! It droops. No good will come of a branch like that, and no ill either. Nothing will, because nothing ever happens to it. Look, look, nothing is happening. Watch!
Why, it's not doing a thing, just hanging off of that tree.
Indeed, sir. Not contributing, not pulling its weight. What purpose does it serve? I tell you, Holmes, nothing ever happens in Surrey. Nothing! Well, apart from the burglary, I mean.
I sat forward in my chair and gave my commander a hard look. Before coming, I had made him agree that no news that might disturb Holmes should be mentioned in his presence. The very last thing I wanted was for my recovering friend to be presented with a case to solve.
Nothing to interest you fellows, I'm sure. Somebody broke into old Acton's house, into his library, and stole a few things. Nothing of value, just some old grimoire.
What? Not only have I forbidden this very topic, but, well, it strains credulity. Why would an aging country squire just happen to have an ancient book of magic lying around?
Not much else to do.
Fortunately, though it seemed the perfect lure for Holmes's interest, he failed to take the bait.
Oh, dreadful. Dull. Let me tell you, most grimoires are filled with utter drivel, just tedious sorcerers droning on and on about their favorite subject, themselves.
Yes, I suppose so. Acton lost nothing but that and an old druidic dagger. He says it was originally used for human sacrifice, but it came to serve as his letter opener.
Ha! He's lying. Don't you see? Probably keeps it around in case he ever needs to do himself in. Too bored to keep on living, I suspect.
Ah, just so, just so. Those were the only items taken. And some string.
String?
Eh.
What kind of string?
I don't know. Usual kind. A very small rope.
But why should a burglar want string? And why should he want another man's string, enough that he breaks into a house to get it?
Holmes, this is no business of ours.
But Watson, I can't think of any reason he'd need this man Acton's string in particular. Unless he were using it to bind something of Acton's, or to mark off an area he wished to use or possess, which belonged to Acton. I don't suppose this Acton fellow is involved in any property disputes, is he?
Well, he is. The other magnates of these parts, Mr. Cunningham and his son Alec, are constantly bickering over this disused old windmill they say belongs to them instead of Acton. It is a baseless claim. Honestly, I think they only pursue it so they have something to stave off the boredom.
Ha! I shouldn't wonder. Dullest place I've ever been. So quiet. Stagnant, even.
I was relieved to see my friend settle back down into bed. Hayter's disclaimer might have been enough to quash Holmes's budding interest if one of the neighbors had not chosen that very moment to come running across the front lawn.
Help! Colonel Hayter! Come quickly! Murder! Murder! Oh, it's the best thing ever!
In a flash, that customary British military briskness reinfused itself into Hayter's aging spine. His eyes gleamed. His back straightened, he practically kicked the French window open and leveled the stem of his pipe as the man entered the room.
Is this true? Has something happened in Surrey?
I know, it's quite unaccountable, but no mistake.
His gaze fell upon Holmes. He stopped, mouth still open, and blinked.
Eyes on me, lad, now, eyes on me. Who is it you think's been murdered, eh?
Oh, Bill Kirwan, sir.
Young William, the Cunninghams' coachman.
Yes, sir, that's the one. Everyone's in a right stir. We all... Pardon me, Colonel, but what's the matter with that gentleman?
Never you mind, Randall, never you mind. You just go round the front and wait for me there. I'll fetch my boot and we'll see if someone's really been murdered or what.
Ada plopped his still-smoking pipe on the dish beside my chair and shuffled out of the room. To my dismay, Holmes began pulling himself out of bed.
Holmes, no, you mustn't.
But he tottered to his feet.
I forbid it, Holmes.
He glanced back at me, and just a flicker of a smile crossed his lips. The smoke from Colonel Hayter's pipe, which had been drifting in lazy loops, wrapped itself around my chest with sudden force. It yanked me backwards into my chair and began winding itself about me like strands of a ghostly rope.
Holmes!
Without looking back at me, he gave me a little what-can-I-do-about-it shrug and reached for his jacket. The smoke began twining upwards towards my mouth, and I realized he meant to gag me with it.
No, damn it! If you're going, I'm going with you.
The smoke tendril hesitated, hovering just beside my right ear.
You won't try to stop me?
I promise.
Then I shall be most happy to have your company, Watson.
And just like that, the smoke released me. To some, it might seem nothing but a trick of the imagination. To me, it was a clear warning. I had no hope of stopping Holmes. The best I could do was go along and try and minimize the damage. The neighbor Randall was waiting upon the front step.
Randall, lead the way!
Despite Holmes's slow pace, we eventually reached the Cunninghams' house. A low stone wall with a wooden gate separated it from the road. On the other side of the lane stood the aforementioned property-disputed, battered old windmill. It was in such a state of disrepair that it could not possibly be functional. Yet its mere proximity to the estate did provide some reason for the Cunninghams to covet it, I suppose. Around the wooden gate stood a knot of locals as a bedraggled constable shuffled about trying to remember how to investigate a crime.
Make way! Make way, I say! I've brought Inspector Warlock Holmes from London to investigate the matter!
His statement at once promoted Holmes to a police rank he did not possess and implied that Colonel Hayter, having heard of the morning's difficulties, had just run all the way to London, secured help, and returned. Yet the worst part of the ridiculous statement was that it included a direct invitation to look at Holmes. The skin had yet to grow back over the scorched portion of his face, so his cheekbone was clearly visible. His lips had somewhat unmummified, but his eyes were still shrunken, milky orbs. There was nothing I could do but offer the best explanation I could think of.
Well, he's not well.
Constable Forrester, what has happened here?
Well, sir, don't really know. Granny Nora saw the body this morning as she's walking down the lane. She come straight round and raised me. I've been here ever since. Word must have got about, though. It's Bill Kirwan, sure enough. Left him just as I found him.
Perhaps, but he'd also let the gawkers crowd around the body and poke at it. I expressed my displeasure to the Colonel.
Well, he's done a poor job of protecting the crime scene. There's no chance of finding a useful footprint now that the whole of Surrey is paraded through.
All right, you've seen him. Now off with you. Only Constable Forrester, Inspector Holmes, Dr. Watson, and myself are to have access to the crime scene. Be about your business.
But Colonel Hayter, sir, this is the only thing that's ever... happened.
All right, then. Off to the tavern to have a drink and a talk about it. Well, looks like just about everybody came out to see.
Not everybody. I gazed up at the house. I wonder that Cunningham and his son Alec did not appear. This body is practically in their garden, after all.
Oh, no. They was here. They come out, expressed sympathy for Bill and his mum, said it was a shocking event that had rocked the community, gave a bit of good news, and headed back inside.
Good news?
They're hiring a new coachman. I mean, we're all very sorry about Bill, but employment vacancies is rare in these parts.
I pushed past him to examine the body. It didn't take me long to determine a cause of death. Holmes, his heart has been torn right out of his chest.
Well, that doesn't prove it's murder.
Hayter was still unwilling to believe that something had actually happened in Surrey.
Look how sharp these gateposts are. He could have fallen on one and torn his heart out. I imagine we'll find it around here somewhere.
Since the scene was already disturbed, I allowed Hayter and Forrester to look around for the misplaced heart, while Holmes and I examined the body.
What do we think, Walton? Redcap? Chupacabrera?
Not unless they were armed. The part of the wound is ragged. The top and right side are clean. Whoever did this used a blade.
Remarkable.
That's not the only thing that's odd. There are no bruises, no other cuts, no damage to his clothes. His hair's still combed, for God's sake. If someone were after you with a knife trying to cut your heart out, don't you think you'd struggle? And look at his face. What would you call that expression?
Contentment? Relief?
Hardly what I would have expected. Perhaps he was drugged. Oh, hello. What's this? Clutched in Bill Kerman's rigid right hand was a piece of paper, a scrap of handwritten note torn from a larger hole. Though it had not profited by the morning's mud bath, it was still legible.
D at 11:45, stir, which should we shall you are read. Written in blood.
No, half written in blood. Look here. Two different people have contributed to this note, alternating words. The words in blood are written in a strong, confident hand. But these are written in normal ink, and see how shaky the letters are? It's as if the writer was scared, or else infirm. Why would anybody choose to make a note in this extraordinary fashion? To my surprise, Holmes had a ready answer.
Blame. Two men have entered into a confederation to perpetrate dark deeds. One is certain in his conviction, one is not. The strong man wished the other fellow to put his hand to it also, to prove his mettle and take some of the blame upon himself, if ever this should come to light.
It was one of those occasions when I found it hard to guess whether his information came from previous experience or some far-off demon feeding him the answer. Whatever the source, I had to admit the idea made a great deal of sense. I rose and walked over to Constable Forrester. Did the victim have anything in either of his hands?
Not that I saw.
Since the entire note could not have been more noticeable, that left only two possibilities and one certainty. Possibility one, Granny Nora had taken the rest of the note when she found the body. A remote chance, I thought. Possibility two, the murderer, or murderers, had ripped the note from Kerwin's hand, failing to notice that a portion of it remained in the dead man's grip. This, I thought, more likely, and that if we could find the other half of the note, its bearer would be our chief suspect. The certainty? Forrester was an idiot. I returned to Holmes's side. I think Kerwin knew the killers and agreed to come. The words at 11:45 suggest an appointment.
Just before midnight. Perfect time to tear a heart out.
But what did they want with it, and where were they going? A disembodied human heart is not the sort of thing you can put in your pocket and go to the shops.
I looked around for answers. The road led off in both directions, so the killer could have made quick progress either way. If they had stayed in the vicinity, there were only two options, the Cunningham's house or the disused windmill.
Constable Forrester, did you search the old mill?
It was locked.
And you let that deter you?
Of course I did. Every trooper knows, if the door's locked, move on to the next one.
Yes, an idiot. We'll get the key from Acton later. For now, let us talk to the Cunninghams.
As the four of us walked to the door, I hung to the rear with Holmes.
Nobody knows about the note but you and me. If anyone should mention it, they may well be the killer. The man in possession of the other half of this note is almost certainly guilty.
Holmes nodded. The door swung open to reveal an aging butler with a face like a droopy old hound's. He stared at us blandly.
Colonel Haydock, Constable Forrester, and two London investigators here to speak to the Cunninghams, father and son.
He gave us a curt little bow and retreated and then returned swiftly.
The masters will see you in the drawing room. This way.
The instant he let us in, I saw things were amiss. The whole place stank of brimstone and blood. The room was in disarray. Books and papers lay strewn about. Alec Cunningham stood wearing an expression of frantic fury. His father leaned on the mantel, dewy-eyed and complacent.
Ah, hello, chaps. Any luck with the investigation?
Alec's weight was on the balls of his feet, as if he might lunge out to strike us at any moment. His father just looked happy to have company. Cunningham Sr. was one of those pleasant, doddering old country gentlemen that England manufactures in extraordinary quantity. His limbs had contracted somewhat with the advancement of age, and as I noted the palsy shaking of his hands, I surmised that I might be looking at one of the authors of our mysterious message.
Quite a bit of luck. It turns out the murderer left a part of a note.
I elbowed him in the stomach. I only meant to stop him from speaking, but in my surprise, I think I jabbed him harder than I meant to. Holmes reeled to one side, bent double, and... vomited forth a horrible stream of congealed blood, complete with a few writhing worms. Probably this was some of his own bodily fluid, trapped in his abdomen during his month-long deathbed stint. It made for an awkward social introduction, but from a medical point of view, I was rather glad to have it out of him. If he noticed one of his guests had just regurgitated a pile of scabby blood into his carpet, Cunningham Sr. seemed to take no special care of it. Instead, he waved a friendly finger at us.
Oh, no, I'm not certain it can be called murder if the slain party came willingly and aloud.
It was Alec's turn to elbow his father. My force had been accidental, but Alec undertook the exercise with purposeful brutality, whereupon the old man proved himself the equal of Holmes by turning to one side and counter-vomiting all down the mantelpiece. The two stricken gentlemen both reached out for something to steady themselves. Fortunately for our investigation, Holmes picked an unstable pedestal beside a lounging chair. No sooner had he placed his weight on it than it tipped forwards, sending both Holmes and the fruit basket that rested atop it plunging to the floor. The basket tipped over, sending three apples, two pears, a sacrificial dagger, and a disembodied human heart bouncing across the carpet.
The murder weapon, I presume?
Aha! So that's where I put it. Now, why should I have left it in a fruit basket? Dear me. Must have been hungry, I suppose.
The discovery of guilt seemed to remove none of the joviality from the elder Cunningham, but his son was another matter entirely. Alec's hand darted for the pocket of his jacket and yanked forth a small revolver. With wild eyes, he swung it towards us. Alec Cunningham scooped up the heart and jumped out the window. He rolled out onto the lawn, gained his footing, and made a beeline for the old windmill.
Oh, I say, he's going to open the demon portal. He said I could watch.
Holmes gave me a look of dread severity. I turned to Cunningham.
Why on earth would you want to do that?
I have lived in Surrey all my life, young man. When I was 9, a boy in town accidentally broke a window and cut his arm.
So?
It is the only event of any note in Reigate's history.
The Laceration of 34, folks call it. Those who are not old enough to have been there curse their youth that they missed it.
And you feel that is sufficient reason to release a demonic invasion upon your unsuspecting peers?
Might be a nice change of pace.
How bad is this situation, Holmes?
Demons! Oh, blood out of my eyes! It hurting me! And as it...
Damn! Forrester, arrest this man for the murder of William Kerwin. Hayter, stay here with this man. Holmes, you and I had better go see what we can do.
He nodded, and we set off. Eschewing the door, we elected to follow Alex through. We opened the broken window to climb out. Forrester began clumsily arresting Cunningham Sr.
Wonderful, wonderful. I've never been under arrest, you know. Fascinating process. I say, would anybody care for a cup of tea while you detain me?
Holmes and I picked our way down the sloping lawn.
Alec Cunningham is armed, Holmes. We are not.
I don't care, Watson.
Yes, well, bear it in mind, won't you?
Very well.
Holmes, what are we to do?
Well, that depends on how good the grimoire was. I was in earnest earlier when I said most of them are rubbish. I should hardly be worried at all if Alec hadn't stolen the string.
The string, Holmes?
He's in a place owned by Acton. If he were to mark off an area of summoning, it would be better if it were delineated by something that likewise belonged to Acton. The fact that he knew this indicates that either Alec or the book he's following contains some considerable level of arcane expertise. Guard yourself, Watson!
He strode up to the windmill's door and laid a hand upon the planks.
Alec Cunningham! Betrayer to the race of man! By what right do you bar us? This place does not belong to you!
The boards contorted like seaweed in a strong current, while the iron nails that bound them together pulled free one by one. In an instant, the way was open. The windmill was non-functional, as I had guessed. Its heavy millstone had been removed from its trundle and leaned up against the far wall. Upon the flat face of this stone were scribed hundreds of arcane characters. On the floor, a circle described in string and marked by candles laid a stage before the foot of the millstone. There stood Alec with the heart of William Kerwin in his left hand. As we watched, he rubbed the heart against the millstone, leaving an arc of gore across its surface. Even so, it was not Alec's left hand, but his right that concerned me, for that one clutched the pistol.
Get back!
I ducked back to one side of the doorway and pressed my back to the stone wall of the windmill. Holmes did the same on the other side. His teeth were gritted and his eyes shone with unalloyed fury.
Wretch! Betrayer! Why would you do this? Why would you treat so cruelly with the world that spawned you?
It's all that old fool Acton's fault. He was going to tear down the windmill. What would become of the millstone? Of the voices within the stone? They have spoken to me since I was a child. Praying here alone. I had to protect them, don't you see? And they helped me. They told me of the book. Of the passage wove of string and blood. Now, at last, I shall greet them. Finally, I shall meet my friends.
Fool! You think Acton was the fool? Can you not feel what is on the other side of that stone? Do not let them in here!
Ah! You cannot stop me!
Oh, I rather think I can!
There was a swirl of black smoke and Holmes was gone. Then, just as suddenly, he reappeared, standing in the circle face to face with Alec Cunningham.
Oh!
Cunningham raised his pistol to fire, but he was too late. With his left hand, Holmes grasped Alec's wrist. With his right, he seized Cunningham's collar.
You wish to see another world? You wish to know what lies without? I will show you. Then, if you still wish to set your friends loose upon this world, you need only tell me so, and I will allow it.
You'll what? Holmes, perhaps we ought not make any hasty promises?
Mantoroff! Admit him!
Oh! Oh! I thought he meant to dash the young man's brains out against the stone, but Cunningham's head went right through the rock's face, as if it were the surface of a pond. To compound this image, Cunningham's arms began to thrash about like a drowning man's. He pulled his wrist free of Holmes' grasp and flailed wildly, smashing Holmes' exposed cheekbone with the barrel of his pistol. Holmes ignored the blow and resolutely held Cunningham down. Cunningham was in the stone up to his shoulders now, and Holmes was up to his wrists. Soon, Cunningham's strength began to fail. His movements lessened until they were not but feeble twitches. Finally, Holmes drew him back out of the stone and dropped him. Cunningham's hair had gone stark white. A strange steam clung to his mouth and nose, curling up in sickly strands. His eyes rolled back and forth in terror.
There. Now you have met your friends. You've beheld a thing that has been seen by probably no more than 5 or 6 living men. Perhaps only by you and me. Do you love them still? Shall I let them come? Only ask, and I will do it.
Please don't.
Come along, Watson. We're safe now. Tomorrow we'll send men with sledges to break that stone to powder. We'll see that Alec here is the last fellow it ruins.
But had it ruined him? Certainly not without a little help from Holmes. And yes, Alec Cunningham was a killer. Yes, engaged in an attempt to doom our world. But to see him, to behold the look of horror in his eyes, had there been no gentler path to victory?
Can we help him?
No man can, I should think.
He meant it to sound disdainful, and it did. But I knew him well enough to hear the ring of terrible guilt beneath his words. Why did he act so rashly if he knew he'd regret it? I could not fathom why Holmes, who drew all his powers from demonic sources, should be so angered to see the same act perpetrated by another. Why did he hold himself harmless, yet lash out so violently against his lesser peers? Then suddenly I realized he didn't. True hate can be focused outwards, but that is not its natural direction. It is an inward-facing malady. True, young Cunningham had nearly caused a catastrophe, yet his was a single act. How much more damage had Holmes himself done over his many years of magical practice? How much more intimately had he woven the brimstone thread into our world through trivial but oft-repeated acts of magic? I knew Holmes was not ignorant of that balance. And yes, some superficial elements of his anger might be directed at Cunningham and the other dabblers he met, but the love he bore for the world of men must, perforce, demand that Holmes reserve the core of his hatred for the man he knew to be the worst of all their ilk. Warlock Holmes. Wretch. Betrayer. That is all there is of the matter, except to relate a few closing points. The second half of the murder note was found in Alec Cunningham's jacket pocket. When joined with the scrap Holmes and I recovered, it read, "If you will only come round at 11:45, we will tear the heart from your chest, which should kill you fairly quickly. Better still, we shall use it to open a demon gate. Thus, you are rid of the terrible boredom we are heirs to, and through your death, the most interesting event ever to grace Reigate shall occur. Consider it." In light of this evidence, the local magistrate had difficulty classifying Kerwin's death as murder. He was quite stymied by the case. As a compromise, Cunningham Sr. agreed to remain under house arrest and be warden to Alec, which indeed was exactly the state in which he'd spent his life up to that point. The event caused quite a stir, and all Reigate residents went with frequency to visit the old man and behold his ruined son. Rare was the day when Cunningham had no gawkers to keep him company. Colonel Hayter was bitterly jealous. Alec Cunningham never again reclaimed his tongue or his senses. Though his father had a devil of a time getting him to take food, Alec would feverishly devour any hair he could lay his hands on. He plucked himself bald in a matter of a few days, much to the delight of the crowds who came to view him. Holmes and I fled. No town so small can contain a secret so large, and Reigate, I knew, would soon become a bit hot for us. I hired another carriage to secret us back to London that very day. Warlock's mood was black and distant as the journey commenced.
I didn't mean to slight you, Watson.
Slight me how?
When I said that only Cunningham and myself had seen such horrors, in the heat of the moment, I forgot your own ordeals. I do not mean to make light of the things you've suffered.
Ah, I've had nothing that terrible ever happen to me. Worst I've ever been is shot.
No, I seem to remember that you once had the entirety of time and space thrust through your chest.
By Jove, I'd forgotten that.
Can't have been pleasant.
No. I certainly don't care to repeat the procedure. He smiled. I smiled back. Are you sorry for what happened to Cunningham, I mean?
Not really, Watson. He got what was coming to him, and the next fellow to endanger our world so callously deserves the same. Even if it's me.
Warlock Holmes No. 2, The Hellhound of the Baskervilles, by G.S. Denning, is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 2017, Gabriel Stephen Denning. All rights reserved. Recorded with permission of the author. Production copyright 2017, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Unauthorized download and/or duplication is prohibited. With performances by Scott McCormick as Dr. John Watson, Eric Messner as Warlock Holmes, with Rose Elizabeth Supan, Mort Shelby, Bradley Smith, Nick DePinto, Yasmin Twazon, Ken Jackson, Steve Wanal, Michael John Casey, and Bob Payne. Directed by Scott McCormick. Adapted for Graphic Audio by Viola Cesario and Scott McCormick. Graphic Audio dialogue editing and sound design by Justin Wirtz. Produced by Rick Rowan, Dwayne Beeman, and Matt Webb. Executive producers, James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett.
Thanks for listening to this Graphic Audio production. Graphic Audio has over 1,000 titles and 100 series to choose from in high-quality download formats. If you'd like to listen to an entire series, you can now conveniently purchase a download series set from GraphicAudio.net. At GraphicAudio.net, you can also earn loyalty rewards points, redeemable towards future online purchases. You can stream or get full downloads directly to your mobile phone or tablet with our newly updated Graphic Audio Access app, available on all Android and Apple devices. Listen to a movie in your mind, on the go, anytime, anywhere. And be sure to listen to our new free Graphic Audio Story Podcast, GASP, featuring all new serialized episodes of a complete full-length story, along with episodes that feature short stories in our graphic audio format. Once you do, we're confident you'll want to subscribe, give us a 5-star review, and recommend us to your friends and family. You can subscribe to GASP through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, and RSS feeds. Coming this fall, look for Graphic Audio Streams, our new streaming subscription service. Sign up for our email newsletter for the latest updates and new releases. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or Instagram. Call 1-800-670-5220 or visit www.graphicaudio.net.